That Great Business Show, Ireland's best business podcast.
ThatGreatBusinessShow.com is brought to you by DeFacto Shaving Oil, the best anyone can get. Made in Ireland, sold worldwide.
Welcome to episode 95 of That Great Business Show, posting on the 8th of July, 2022. Fáilte isteach. We're always looking for brilliant small business ideas that would allow our loyal listeners, that's Team GBS, to set up on their own quickly, cheaply, and hopefully profitably. On the last episode, we had the wonderful Monaghan Tones of Shawnee McCleary of Street School, who will have you or your kids up and running in the food business in a week. Do listen back. This week, we have another very different business for you. We'll be telling you about becoming a pilot. But you won't have to work for Michael O'Leary, because you will be piloting your own career, and it's highly affordable. Also, if you're setting up a business, we have found a way to save you hundreds, if not thousands, on your business tech. And what happens when your legally formed company goes dormant or out of business? We'll tell you why it's very important to tie up the loose ends. And all of these great insights are brought to you thanks to DeFacto Shaving Oil, the world's best shaving oil. Not a beard oil, made in Mayo, sold worldwide.
DeFacto Shaving Oil, smooth as.
Now, back in the day, if you wanted to train as a pilot, I think it could have cost well over 100,000 euro and took something like 2 years. But that is so yesterday. Today, you can become a pilot for a fraction of that cost and time. Okay, so you won't be up in the air, which for me is a very good thing. But you will be starting off in an industry that looks like it will be very big indeed. That is the drone industry. And why do I say it'll be big? Well, drone proponents live by the three D's. If it's dull, dirty or dangerous, then a drone should be or will be doing it, they say. The fabulously named Julie Garland, one-time barrister, is the boss at Dublin-based Avtrain, who says they are Europe's leading drone training and certification body, setting the standards for others to follow. And she joins me now. Julie Garland, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Hi, Conal. It's lovely to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me on The Great Business Show.
The first question is always random and nothing to do with what we'll be talking about. But why didn't they call you Judy Garland?
Funny enough, I have been asked that once or twice before.
Not surprised.
It's my parents, when they christened me, called me Juliet, actually. And my dad spelt it with multiple T's and multiple E's, as many as he could fit on the page. And it was after that they decided they were going to abbreviate it to Julie. And it was about a few weeks after my christening that somebody came along and said, oh, you named her after the actress. And they said, who, which actress?
No.
Really? And I used to, the best part of this is I used to, when I was an apprentice in Aer Lingus, I used to work with a guy called Warren Beatty. So we were like kids going to a nightclub and we would have our IDs, we asked for IDs, and it'd be Julie Garland and Warren Beatty, and they would just refuse to believe it. And then I flew airplanes, and as a captain, I'd have to put on my airplane voice now for you.
So, do it.
So I was like, good morning, ladies and gentlemen. This is your captain, Julie Garland, speaking. With me today is First Officer John Lennon. And I then had to stop and wait until the laughter would stop in the background.
There was actually
a John Lennon. He's still flying. He's a captain with Aer Lingus now.
And is Warren Beatty still with us?
Warren Beatty, absolutely, yes.
Warren Beatty, I need to have you on the podcast. I don't care what you talk about, but I want to say that I had Warren Beatty
absolutely.
And almost Judy Garland.
Yeah, and John Lennon too. We can get John in too.
The whole lot. You have mentioned some of your fantastic background. Tell us the story about how you ended up doing what you're doing.
Sure. So I suppose what I've ultimately ended up with was a combination of a technical skills coupled with operational experience in an airline along with the legal side of it. So just to give a little bit of history on that, I started off in the last century as I was left school, wanted to be a pilot. My grandfather had me in a flight simulator at 8 years of age.
And I thought a flight simulator was a machine.
It is. It's a flight simulator. So he had me out at Dublin Airport.
He brought you there. I thought you said that he was.
No. He was definitely my grandfather. And he definitely brought me out Aer Lingus. He was a captain with Aer Lingus. He was actually ultimately the fleet captain on 747s with Aer Lingus before he retired. But he was at that stage a captain with Aer Lingus. And they had a BAC 111, a back 111 simulator. And he brought me out there when I was 8 years of age. And I went flying and the knobs and dials and buttons. And it was so exciting. And to actually be in control of an airplane. And it's, believe me, a flight simulator, even though they were older flight simulators, they're so exciting, particularly for a child. So that was the initial part of it. As soon as I did that, that was it. I wanted to be a pilot. But when I left school, there was nobody recruiting pilots. There wasn't the Aer Lingus, sponsorship scheme or anything like that going on at the time. So I decided that I would, Aer Lingus advertised as an aircraft maintenance engineer, as an apprentice. So I said, yes. My dad really encouraged me, drove me up for the application and everything else, went in, 7,000 people applied. And, fortunately, I was one of those who was accepted.
Well,
there was
you.
40 accepted out of that 7,000, 20 A and C, which is the kind of the mechanical side, and 20 avionics. And out of that, there was two girls. So I was very delighted out of the 7,000 to end up being the female candidate, the chosen candidate. And so that was fantastic. Really loved it. And it was a great introduction. And it's a great background to have when you do go flying airplanes, because you understand the technical part of it. And having said that, there's nothing worse as an engineer of a pilot who knows a little bit too much about the airplane, because they start picking holes in it or undoing things or trying to fix things themselves. So I went on then from being an aircraft maintenance engineer. An opportunity arose where I had saved up enough money myself and also was helped as well along the way. And I decided to do the self-sponsorship route. So I went off, did my flight training, went to South Africa. I'd been working for our contractors in between with Hugh Flynn there, who's been hugely supportive throughout my whole career, and down to South Africa. And at the time, it was the late 90s in Johannesburg. It wasn't a great place for a single white female to be. It wasn't the most friendly environment, but I went down there, did my flight training there, and then came back out to Weston Airport. And I did my instructor's rating out in Weston Airport, out at the National Flight Centre. I got into Air Arran, and as it turned out, the first person that I went flying with in Air Arran was somebody that my grandfather had trained, and now he was training me. So it was really history in the making. I spent nearly 10 years flying, and then decided that I went from Air Arran to as a first officer to flight safety officer to captain, training captain. Then I went to CityJet as a direct entry captain and type rating instructor. So I did progress throughout my career, and it got to the point where I was in the left-hand seat. I've been 10 years flying, and I decided...
The left-hand seat, that's the important one, is it?
It is, yes,
that's
it is.
That's the driving seat.
Well, they say there's three seats in the cockpit. There's the left seat, the right seat, and there's two pilots sitting in all of those, but the two votes go to the left side and one vote goes to the right side. So ultimately, when a decision has to be made, it does come down to the person sitting in the left-hand seat.
I should be referring to you as Captain Julie Garland.
I'm quite comfortable with Julie.
Okay. So what happened next? Because this gets very interesting.
So I decided at this point that I wasn't going to retire from the left seat of an airplane. I had no intention of stopping flying, but I didn't want to retire from the left seat of an airplane. It's a fabulous job, and there is no better view from an office than you will get flying an airplane. It's just super.
I'd hate
I know, but some people don't like flying, but we'll bring you out on a flight out in Weston Airport, and I promise you, you'll love it by the time we get you back on the ground.
Nope.
You'll be relieved to be back on the ground, possibly.
So
I decided I wasn't going to retire from the left seat, and it wasn't going to keep me going until I retired. So I decided that I was going to study while I still had enough grey matter to get me through a college course without struggling too much. And I looked at law, and I had some friends, and I had two friends in particular who are judges, and I had some barrister friends as well, and they really encouraged me towards the legal side based on knowing me as they did, knowing my propensity to argue, and they thought that this would be a wonderful career for me in the future. So I decided to study law. I did the diploma at law in King's Inns, and then I did the barrister at law degree program, which was full time. So it was a long journey. It was a hard journey. I was working full time flying, and I was studying at the same time.
Jesus, that's a lot.
Yeah, it was a lot. It was really a lot. And I also managed to, carry on flying during that time as well. I was doing some quality management and compliance monitoring out in the flying school as well. So I was trying to keep everything going. And then I got called to the bar. So I got called to the bar in 2010. I was incredibly proud of myself because I hadn't been particularly academic before that. And to go from something that's much more, very much practically based, the engineering is very practical, the flying, even though there's some academics in it, it's still quite practical. And to go from all of that into something that is purely academic was really an achievement. So I got called to the bar, and then CityJet offered me another leave of absence because another year's leave of absence, because at that point we were in the height of the recession, I was probably the most expensive commodity in CityJet as a training captain. So they figured that if I take another year's leave of absence, the business would have bounced back at that stage. So they offered it to me. I took it happily. And then I stood up in a courtroom, and that was the beginning of the end. You know, once I was standing up and I was being paid to argue, and that to
the
me was just the perfect.
I would say,
yeah,
is fantastic.
It is. It really, really is. And again, there's nothing like it. I mean, you compare it back to flying. Flying is amazing. All of these, each of the careers that I've had, you know, have really been incredible. But I started to miss aviation, though. I did start to miss it. And
you just told me that you missed the smell of
Jet A1 in the morning. it really is, you know, it's in your blood, and it's very much in my blood. It's, you know, particularly coming from my grandfather all the way through to myself. My brother's a pilot as well.
It is. I've often noted that it is a family affair.
Yeah, I think it's something that it gets instilled in you from a very young age. And I think it's not just about it being a career. It's about the sense of pride that you have in your job. It's about even if you just look at a pilot in their uniform and the pride that they take in their appearance and everything, you know, there's so much. And there's also a lot of discipline in it, which, you know, for some is great and for others isn't so good, but it is a very disciplined career.
So you have gone back to...
I spent 5 years at the law library, and during that time I had started to get involved with drones. And then
why?
What happened with drones was that the Irish Aviation Authority, I had always been very involved with the Irish Aviation Authority here throughout my career, particularly training pilots. And also we'd set up a maintenance, we'd done some really fun stuff. We had like set up a floatplane base on the water where we licensed a piece of water to become an airport. And we'd done some really funny, I think the Aviation Authority I'll go back to that now. I think the Aviation Authority here actually have a Julie department, because it's like every time I come to them with something, it's always something pretty off the wall.
So
or
go
different.
Back and what did you do?
Yeah, so we set up a floatplane base on, it was actually down in Mount Shannon, and it was for a company that were based in Killaloe, and they wanted to start operating float planes from Dublin to Cork Harbour, from Dublin port to Cork Harbour.
When you say float planes, you're talking about flying boats or flying...
Yeah, yes, yeah. Yes, airplanes that will land on the water.
Yeah,
absolutely. Now, these were, they actually have floats on them, so they've got like two floats, one down each side. But we did also fly what was a Grumman Goose as well, which is one of these really bulbous airplanes. It's like a Second World War airplane. It's stunning. It's still actually based out in Weston Airport. And the Goose is probably one of my favourite airplanes, along with the Spitfire, which I got to fly as well. But
you did not?
I did, yes, I did. Sorry, I'm starting to show off now.
That is impressive.
It is. And
how exciting. This is a business show. We're going to go talk business in a second. But to fly a Spitfire, that is pretty impressive.
Absolutely incredible. I got to fly it from Weston Airport after the Bray Air Show back to Duxford Airport. And
how exciting was it?
It was the most thrilling thing I have ever done in my life. And part of it is because there was a lot of historic with regards to it. My grandfather had flown a Spitfire.
Had he?
And I was, yes, and I was getting
RAF
to do it with the RAF. Yeah. Yes. So it was really going back in history, going back in time. You could really feel him there with me. And it was just absolutely incredible. And then just the smell, the noise, the atmosphere. We dipped and dived around the Welsh mountains and then back into Duxford. And there had been a display on that day. So Duxford is really busy. So yes, it was absolutely incredible. And I was very fortunate. And it was actually the original Irish Air Corps Spitfire that had been repainted, completely refurbished. So it was the original training aircraft for the Irish Air Corps, and in complete Irish Air Corps colours as well that I got to fly. So
we have to stop talking about stuff like this.
Airplanes.
Let us get into the business of drones. Drones are going to be huge.
Sure.
Talk to me.
So when I started with drones, it was back in kind of 2014, 2015. And what happened was the Aviation Authority here, they have a huge amount of foresight, and they're visionary and renowned for that across Europe. What happened was back in 2014, 15, they saw a dramatic increase in the amount of drones in our skies. Most of them were toys, most of them were small little drones, but still they've had a dramatic impact on aviation and also on people on the ground if you're flying them over their heads. So they talked to me about it. We had long conversations about it, where I had been involved in training since I'd started flying, and really looking, as well as having the legal background too. Now, all of this starts to tie in together. And they decided that they wanted to have a structure in place where you could actually train people to become a pilot. They could actually license them, that you could actually facilitate the industry growth and the movement of the industry forward, rather than trying to prevent it or stifle it. So we came up with a statutory instrument. There was an existing statutory instrument there, and then we updated it to the Statute 563 of 2015 was what it ultimately ended up at, ingrained in my memory forever.
Yes, my lord, it's Statute 563.
It's definitely ingrained. So we've lived by that for the last 6 years. And where AvTrain came about was what actually happened was...
Which I presume is short for aviation training, is
it? Yeah, yes, exactly, yeah. So where Avtrain came about was in kind of 2018, 2019, the European regulations were coming into force. They were due to come in on the 1st of July 2019. And as you know, we had a little bit of a catastrophic year in 2019. So with COVID, they were pushed back by 6 months. But once I could see the structure for the European regulation, it meant that I wasn't doing training. I'd just done it as a hobby really before that. And it meant now that I wasn't doing training for the grant of a national license that was only valid in Ireland. You could now do it for a European license. It's all of Europe. It's under what's called EASA, which is the European Aviation Safety Agency.
I have never come across in my little bit of research so many acronyms then around both your website and all the others that I've been looking at. Yeah. You don't speak English. You speak in acronyms.
I think I could make a whole sentence just with acronyms without ever actually using a vowel or a noun.
People who are listening to the podcast want to know urgently, how do they become pilots of drones and where do they make a living out of this?
Yeah, so there's two things. I suppose we've moved towards the way the EASA regulations have structured now is they've gone towards looking at risk, and the risk your operation is to uninvolved people. So you need different levels of qualification and certification depending on how much risk your aircraft is to somebody who's not involved, whether they're on the ground or in the air. So what that means is that if you're flying a very small drone, but you're flying it near people, or if you're flying a very large drone, but you're flying it very far away from people, they're all low risk environments. If it, you know, a small little Mavic Mini, 249 grams, it'd fit in the palm of your hand. You know, if you're flying that close to people, it's not going to do any harm. And same with large drones far away. So that's the kind of lowest level of risk. And then you build up from that, and you build up the amount of training, the certification, the qualifications that you hold. You build up how much risk management you have. And then you can build up to flying in different types of environments, populated environments, built up environments, closer to airports. So all of it is gradually increasing your skill set as you increase your knowledge of the aircraft. We do the training from everything from a hobby pilot right the way up to somebody who wants to fly really large drones in populated areas and congested areas and close to airports.
And talk to me about that, because that is the future, the big ones in our cities.
Yeah, for sure. Now, you know, if you look, I know you know Bobby Healy, and you look at what Manor are doing. I mean, it's incredible, because one of the things that they're doing is normalising drones into our day-to-day life. And this is really, it's not about just societal acceptance, it's about societal desirability, so that people actually want these services. There's so many ways and areas where we can bring this into people's lives, into their day-to-day life, where it really benefits them. Things like looking at medical deliveries, medical supplies, but actual critical medical supplies, so things like test samples, blood samples, organ delivery, you know, looking at blood supplies and blood and actual, you know, donors being moved from one place to the other. So we can do all of that in city centre environments.
At the moment.
We need more redundancies in the technology, and we need to prove those redundancies. So what we need to do is...
By the redundancy, you mean that when a bit fails, that something else steps in.
Exactly. It's just called fail safe. And so what it means is when something goes wrong, if something goes wrong, because something will go wrong, that the rest of the systems are capable of coping with it. And if ultimately everything goes wrong and it gets to the point where the aircraft can't fly or shouldn't fly, well, then a parachute would be deployed so that the aircraft flutters nicely to the ground rather than injuring anybody or hurting anybody. So that's what we need to get to that standard. And when we've got to that standard, we also need to prove this on a continuous basis, ongoing. And that's what's taking time. That's why we're not seeing them overhead or, you know, over our heads right now today. We have to build up that confidence. And you have to build that up by operating in smaller areas, in more remote areas, build up those hours, build up the confidence that the public has confidence in what you're doing as well, and that they desire it.
I will remind people, when cars were first introduced, remember they used to have a man, and it was a man at the front with a red flag. And he used to be, I don't know, 20, 30 feet ahead, just in case. What's the future that you see? Because obviously you know this industry very, very, very well. Paint me the picture, say in 10 years, maybe it wouldn't even be 10. What's going to be above us in our cities?
Yeah, I think our city environments are not particularly well designed for drone operations and for drone flights to take place. So I don't think in a city centre, I mean, I live in an apartment block in Blackpitts in the middle of the city centre. I'm not going to have a drone delivering anything to me anytime soon, because the infrastructure isn't there and it's flying over too many people. The risks are just too high. But in suburbs, you're going to start seeing this happening regularly, and in remote environments, which is where it's really needed. You know, you can't order. My sister lives down in Carrick and Shannon, a couple of miles outside of town, and I try and order a pizza, you know, and 2 hours later you get a cold, mushy pizza that's been rocking around the back of a car. So, you know, these are the places, but really the other area that we're going to see it where it will have a dramatic impact on our lives is in the medical supplies. And it really, the amount of change that can go on there, but that will be in an environment where you can have it in a built-up environment, because these drones will have all the redundancies and you won't have all of these other drones. So that's one area, I think. But the main area I see it is actually on the kind of the future mobility, advanced air mobility. And we're involved with an organisation called Future Mobility Campus Ireland down in Shannon, and where we're looking, it's a centre of excellence for autonomy, and it's a testbed.
You don't refer to it as that, do you? Because I was reading about this. It's FMCI or FCMI.
Yeah, FMCI, yeah. So Future Mobility Campus Ireland. So yeah,
another acronym.
FMCI, another acronym. That's why I tried to say it out first. So, but yes, it is. It's FMCI. And we do refer to it all the time. And what we're doing there is looking through the future of autonomy. And it's about integration. It's multimodal, interoperable multimodal transport. So when you are at home and you're looking to book your holiday, you're going to be able to go online, go to an app, and you'll just say, I want to go from my house to my apartment in Portugal. And this will book your car to come, probably autonomous car, to come and collect you outside your house. It'll bring you to a vertiport. At that vertiport, which is where your new generation aircraft, which takes off and lands vertically but flies horizontally, you'll step onto that. That'll bring you to the airport. You'll step off at the airport and you'll probably get a scooter down to your airplane and often step on your airplane, and same at the other end.
When will we see these?
So 2024 is optimistic.
That's only 2 years away.
Exactly. It's a very optimistic. Volocopter have very much said that they are pushing to have the first of their aircraft certified by 2024 to fly at the Paris Olympics. We're being somewhat more conservative and we're saying the Ryder Cup in 2027, all the guys you see now coming in helicopters and going off to Adair Manor, we'll be bringing them across from our base at Future Mobility Campus Ireland in Shannon across to the Ryder Cup by an eVTOL aircraft.
You've actually stopped me because I cannot believe this. Really?
Yeah, really.
But where are you going to get all the whatever they're called, the copters or
so,
the drones,
yeah,
or the...
So,
where are you going to find those?
Well, this is what I figure my role is in all of this. It's bringing all the pieces of the jigsaw together. So it's because it's not just about the aircraft. So if you look at Avalon, you look at... they have just invested in Vertical Aerospace, and they've ordered over 500 of these aircraft to be manufactured. And they've got customers, they've already all of those aircraft placed. So these are brand new airplanes that are just coming off. We're going to Farnborough Airshow the week after next, and they're going to have their full-size model. They're so excited. Jonas Slattery actually had it at Avalon E a couple of weeks ago. We had a conference at their headquarters in Ballsbridge, and he had a scaled model there. Really, really exciting. And, you know, these manufacturers, Supernal is another company that we work with, as well as a subsidiary of Hyundai. We've also worked with Elroy, Pipistrel, various others. So the industry will be freight as well first, and then we'll put people into them. But we will have pilots in them, first of all. And this is another thing, which is where we have another company called Vertex Aero. And we're looking there at training the pilots who will initially fly these, what will ultimately be autonomous airplanes.
Which is the perfect segue into the people who are still waiting to find out, how do I become and how much will it cost a drone operator or a drone pilot, I think you like to call them. Or even now that I know this other new thing exists, a pilot for one of these up and down jobbies.
Yeah, sure. So the best place, and not just a little bit of self-promotion, but is on our website, we have a free video there, which goes through each of the different types of licenses and what licenses
they hold. It's a very nice website as well. I went through it. Very, very detailed.
Thanks, Conal. Thank you. So there's a free video there, and they can do the first license they do is they register on the Irish Aviation Authority's website. It's called MySRS. They register as a pilot and as an operator. They do their A1, A3 exam there, which is the basic lowest level of exam. Then they come onto our website.
How much does that cost?
That'll be €30 for them to register as a pilot.
Okay. And then to do the exam?
They come onto our website. They do their Open A2. That'll cost them €149. And then it costs them €45 to get the actual license issued.
So far, so affordable.
Then
we
have the next level up, which is where they start getting into wanting to actually use their drone in a commercial realm where they want to. It doesn't have to be. You know, the whole idea of the licensing and the requirements are based on risk, not on whether or not you're charging money for it. So, but most people who are bidding for work or looking to do survey work, looking to use their drone in more congested environments, and also looking to use their drone possibly in airspace where otherwise it might be restricted. So it could be restricted due to infrastructure, it could be restricted due to proximity to the airport. And that's €650. So it's very, very affordable. And this is to start your career.
650 euro.
Yeah.
How long does it take?
It takes, we do the first part of the course is online, which is about just over five hours, and you can do that at your own pace. The second part of the course is a 1 day live webinar. And then the third part of the course is the practical assessment. We also spend kind of a half day with you going through your operations manual, where we write a bespoke operations manual for you. So by the time you come out of it, you have your license, your pilot's license, you have an operational authorization, which is your company or your operator allows you to operate a drone. And then you have your actual practical experience done as well.
And is it essential to have one of those licenses? Is anybody enforcing that?
Yes, very much so. The Irish Aviation Authority are, for the circumstances where you require it, you may see there's been some quite significant enforcement actions taken by the Aviation Authority recently. So I'm the chair of the Unmanned Aircraft Association here in Ireland.
Well, of course.
Of course. who've also put me on to the...
And you call it the unmanned. You have to call it the unpersoned. Sure.
Yes, and I should be using that. Actually, uncrewed is actually going to be
uncrewed,
the latest.
Okay.
Uncrewed. So yes, I'm going to have to get into my habit of, and I should certainly be getting into the habit of using uncrewed. So
650, and then you have your license to start your business. What does a business look like? Is there money to be made?
I'm gently
trying to find out.
Yeah, sure.
Is there a real career in this?
Sure. So there's a lot of people who are out there are adding this on as an addition to their business. So they are an architect and they use a drone as part of their day-to-day work. They are a cameraman or camera person, or they are, they already have something. They're a videographer. They're using this as a tool within what they're doing. And this goes back to the dull, dirty and dangerous. These are tools to assist us in what we do, because a lot of people can be quite fearful about the impact that drones could have in our lives of taking over people's jobs. That's not what it's about. It's about assisting us to do our jobs and to do our jobs more efficiently and safer. So think of any industry that you possibly can, and then you'll find somewhere where you can apply drones to it. We do a lot of work with things like the Irish Coast Guard and a lot of those areas where, you know, the value of a drone is exponential. But just to go back to your question from earning money, you can earn money out of this as, you know, camera. We have a lot of people coming into us who are photographers. Surveyors is probably the other biggest area, construction industry, security, you know, people using them now in security where they might be a security guard in a premises or something, and they can stay in their own comfort and not have to tackle somebody outside and actually go and have a look around and see what's actually going on somewhere.
You in the blue hoodie, I can see it from my drone.
Absolutely. And you can have voice controls on them as well. And you can have big lights as well that shine on people as well.
Tell me more. Tell
but
me if
it is. It is. It is something, I suppose, that's limited by our own imagination, is all I would say about it.
But do you have the imagination? Because you kind of live and breathe.
Yeah.
You breathe those fuel fumes that you like.
Yeah, so, yeah, absolutely. So I think that...
Paint me the picture of the future.
Every airplane that we have now, I think that the future is going to be when we look towards the advanced air mobility and we look towards making people's lives easier by moving them very quickly from one place to the other, which, as I say, is the multimodal transport. So you're going to have, and it's initially in the next 20 years, it's going to be, they're going to be a bit more like bus stations, these vertiports that we're going to have around the place rather than them. You're not going to have an airplane hovering outside your house where you step out on a walkway and get into it and fly away. You know, that's way into the future. It will happen, but it's way into the future. What we will have is the likes of bus stations, like, say, Houston Station to Dublin Airport. You'll be able to get on. It'll be like similar to a helicopter, but it's not dramatically quieter. It's electronic, so therefore you're not getting the emissions. You know, we're calling them eVTOL before electric. You're not getting the emissions. So I see that as the future. And I see drones themselves, the smaller aircraft that we're talking about, the small little unmanned aircraft being used in our day-to-day life for everything, for absolutely everything, for delivering your shopping to your medication from your pharmacy to your video. Well, we don't get DVDs anymore, do we?
No, I don't think we do. I have a lot, though, if you want some. Quick question. The Metrolink is going to cost $9.5 billion. Is that a waste of money if the world is going to go into drones?
Well, I read a headline the other day, which I just thought was very apt. I have Sharunas working with me, who said, "This is amazing. We're going to have a Metrolink." And I said, "Oh, are we? Okay, great." And he said, "I think I read a headline the other day that every time we've had the announcement of the Metrolink, we've had an immediate recession, and we're on our fourth at this stage since it was first announced." So So the idea of taking people, the Metrolink is going to dig up every road, every channel, unless we're going underground with it. It's absolutely a waste of time.
I think because all it's going underground, but
it's the just the construction of it alone. Whereas if you take what we're doing with the eVTOL aircraft and the advanced air mobility industry, we're taking what is already existing infrastructure, jumping around from rooftops, going from one place to the other, using what's there already, using what's suitable to move people from place to place without congesting the roads further and emissions free. And this is a critical part of this, is the emissions and looking towards green energy and also the supply of that energy.
I presume, I'm just going to guess that the metro presumably is run on electricity as well.
I would certainly hope so.
Yeah. So somebody who wants to get involved can get onto AvTrain. This is your opportunity for a big ad.
Yes.
AvTrain, AvTrain, and sign up there. Once you pay your $650, can you go up again? What's the maximum that you'll take off people?
Yeah, sure. Oh, well, it's endless, actually. There's no cap or limit on it. What we do is it's avtrain.aero, because it's unusual having the .aero domain. And $650 is for your operational authorization. If you want to do what's called a SORA risk assessment, which is a specific operations risk assessment. Sorry, yet another acronym. But if you want to do that, we do that on a consultancy basis and depending on the complexity of the operation that you want to carry out. So we're doing a lot of those at the moment. We're also doing the next step up, which is called an LUC, which is a Light Unmanned Aircraft Systems Operator Certificate. And at the moment, we have already gone through one of these. We were doing beyond visual line of sight flights from Shannon Airport across to Foynesport last year, operating for FedEx, which was really incredible. But we're doing those now, and we've got three airlines on board. And these three airlines are going to be looking to moving, ultimately flying unmanned aircraft, not necessarily people initially, but they will certainly be looking towards moving freight from one place to the other.
And you're in it.
Absolutely happening now.
How big is AvTrain as a company?
So we have three full-time people at the moment working with us, and we have two more coming on board and two part-time.
And can you go international with this?
Yes, very much so.
Like, it's almost made for it, isn't it?
Absolutely, very much so. And that's why, I mean, I've held off on this. I've been doing this since 2015, but waited until 2019 to actually give up my day job and the nice salary that goes into the bank every month in order to do this, because we needed this European regulation. And the thing is that the European regulation that we have now, it's not just a European regulation, it's recognised as a global gold standard. So that allows us to expand globally, and not just across Europe.
Do you need investment?
Yes, we would love some investment.
Shout out. Come on,
later on this year, we're going to be looking to raise money. And that's really to try and expand from the platform point of view. We want to look at putting a simulator out so that we can actually build a flight simulator so that we can train the practical side of the remote pilot. Scaling is difficult. We can scale everything from a theoretical knowledge point of view. It's an online course. But actually practically assessing somebody, we need to be able to do that remotely as well. So we want to start building a simulator. And we have so many plans. So be delighted to hear from anybody who really wants to get involved in this space.
How many zeros do you want to raise?
We're probably looking initially at around 800,000 to a million. So a very small amount initially. But we're very lean as well. So what that can bring to the business is going to be colossal, and we will be taking over the world.
Fantastic. Final question. Who would you hire in a heartbeat?
So when you'd first asked me this question, I had come up with one person, which was Herb Keller. And Herb, the reason for that was when he set up Southwest, that everything he did was
and
in the face of adversity.
For those who don't know who or what Southwest is, it was the original of the species of
the low-cost carriers.
Low-cost, yeah. In the States.
Yeah, yeah. So Herb was definitely, and then you suggested that maybe I would choose somebody who unfortunately hasn't passed on to the next world. So two people that I have are Martin Curley and Donal Slattery. Martin Curley being one of the most innovative people that I've had the pleasure of coming across, where it was from your show that I'd actually heard from him when I got in touch with him, having heard him on your show.
Did you?
Yes, I did. And it was immediately
Believable.
Absolutely incredible. Really, really incredible. Absolutely blew me away. His thought process, his way of thinking, his attitude towards innovation and his raw enthusiasm is just infectious. So Martin, certainly, absolutely. And the other one is Donal Slattery as well, who I did mention actually briefly earlier on, which is Avalon E. And that's really looking, the one thing that Martin and Donal both have in common is looking at innovation, looking at change, looking about how we bring it out and embracing technology to do it. And that's very much what's in my core as well. So.
And Donal is a world leader.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, without
Fantastic.
Any doubt. So.
Great story. I could talk to you about this all day.
I'd love to.
Well, yeah, I think you could as well.
For sure.
Julie Garland, founder of AvTrain. Does that describe you correctly? Yeah?
Yes.
Thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thanks so much, Conal. Absolute pleasure.
Thinking of travel? If so, make sure to make Defacto, the world's best shaving oil, your choice of travel companion. A 25-milliliter bottle of Defacto means no hassle at airports, no bulky cans to carry, and the guarantee of the world's best shave. DefactoShave.com.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Rate and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with five-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
All that great business show advertisers are Team GBS approved. Back them.
That great business show.
This morning in the Irish Times, I saw a small ad under legal notices announcing that Julie and Dorothy Limited of BlackRock in Dublin were asking the company registrar to remove their name from the company's register. The ad says that they never carried on a business and had no assets, but still, the ad and the process costs money. So, what would have happened if they, and the many thousands of other dormant companies, did absolutely nothing and just let it lie? Well, on behalf of Team GBS, I had to ask the question. And here to answer all of the above and more is one of my favourite company secretaries, Conor Sweeney, founder of CLS Chartered Secretaries based in Carlow. Welcome to that great business show, Conor Sweeney.
Thank you, Conor. Thanks for having me. Delighted to be here.
You have been 21 years thinking of an answer about this.
I have.
There are, I'm going to guess, hundreds of thousands of dormant companies, are there?
There are. And I think what's happened in the last 2 years is there's been no involuntary strike-off. So for the last couple of years, pre-COVID, about 5,000 companies were struck off involuntarily every year. So now we have, probably because there's been no involuntary strike-off, we've about 10 to nearly 15,000 of those companies, on average, sitting on the register.
And when you say involuntary, that means that they haven't done their paperwork and that kind of stuff. They want to stay in business, but they haven't done the business. They haven't done the paperwork.
Yeah, so take it back to compliance. Every company has to file a return every year. Okay, so you file a return.
It doesn't matter if you're doing nothing. You still have to do a return. And you have to audit that as well, do you?
Well, most of them are audit exempt. If you're under the 12 million turnover, you're audit exempt.
Well, if you do,
you've got to file on time.
Yeah.
And then if you file on time, you keep your audit exemption and you're fine. What happens is if companies go late, then they're into losing audit exemption and having to go to district court to retain it, or they have to pay an auditor and pay late filing penalties.
Even though there's nothing to audit.
Even though there's nothing to audit, yeah.
Now, you know these things, and I don't. How much does an auditor charge to audit what isn't there to be audited?
You'd have to ask somebody like an auditor. It can be anything, really.
Because what they're doing, they're putting their name against it. So he, she will certainly charge you into the hundreds, if not tipping into more, just to file, because it's all done electronically.
Exactly. So, and the auditors have to fill out their process, they have to comply with their legal regulations and their audit regulations. So there is that cost, but unfortunately for those small businesses, they might have ran into hard times of COVID, can't get the money to do the audit, can't get the compliance, and they just walk away. You know, they've no choice, or they don't have the money.
And that is perfect, because that's what I want to find out. When you walk away, it's kind of an Irish thing, isn't it? Which is, we say, like, I presume there isn't one of these in Germany, but in Ireland there must be hundreds of thousands. It'll do. That'll be fine. Sure, it'll be grand. N-O, that's not how it works, is it?
No, not. And look, you do feel sorry for these companies that, you know, if they have hit hard times, you know, and that's why, you know, if you want to do something like a voluntary strike-off, you have to be up to date. You have to have no assets and liabilities. Whereas you're looking to appoint a liquidator then if the company is insolvent and you mightn't have the funds to pay a liquidator.
So what happens then?
So then the company may get just struck off the register.
Which is fine.
Which is fine.
But this is my point. If you leave it long enough and bad enough, it almost takes care of itself.
I don't know if you saw last week, and I know you read a lot of these things, but the Director of Corporate Enforcement issued their annual report.
I did.
And in the back of that, there was about 7 or 8 examples of what happened, these types of companies that get struck off. And what they look for is, was their debts in the company prior to in the last set of financial statements before it was struck off. So if you're shown liabilities of 500,000, then the director of corporate enforcement will make contact with that company and ask the director to prove at the time the company was struck off or since you haven't paid off those debts. And if they haven't, then they will bring typically disqualification proceedings against those directors.
And people don't like that.
And they don't. And if you've a couple of companies, so it's fine if you've just got one company, you're never going to act as a director again, then, you know, what have you to fear in one sense? And often those companies will take what's called a disqualification undertaking. So they'll save you having to go to court. They'll just say, I'll take it. And you typically get 4 years disqualification. And what that means is you can't be a director or a secretary or manage a company for that period of disqualification.
Now, you say manage a company.
Yes.
But is that real? I understand that you are disbarred from putting the name director against your name, but you could actually run the business. And people do.
Well, and we have seen instances where directors have acted as directors while disqualified, and Director of Corporate Enforcement has taken cases against those. Now, it doesn't come up too often, but we have seen cases where they've been taken. But in the main, most people don't. They've just stepped back and taken it. Whereas if you operate a large number of companies and you're facing disqualification proceedings, that's something you're going to have to take necessary steps. And if you see some of the cases, there was disqualifications. The highest one was issued last year, with 15-year disqualification against the director.
So that's the end of the business, really, or one's business life anyway.
Exactly. Well, okay. It should be.
Now, the business in which you are in is being a company secretary.
Yes.
And I think, because I know something about company secretarialship or secretaryship, whatever word it might be, there are people listening to this podcast who have kids. They will never have heard about being a company secretary. The more I found out about it, it is a little hidden gem. Discuss why kids should be pushed, forced, kicked, dragged into being a company secretary.
It would be great if we could change the title, but even if you look at, in the Companies Act, company secretary is named, you know, director and company secretary as one of the officers. In the UK government, you'll see at the moment, all Boris Johnson's secretaries are resigning left, right and centre. So the word company secretary has an importance and the role is quite important. But if you look at the Chartered Governance Institute, which is the regulated body in the UK and Ireland for chartered secretaries, the role is huge. It brings you into so many different areas, from acting as company secretary for a large PLC. You could do it for a charity. You can go into professional services like myself, or you can work in accountancy firms, law firms, professional firms like myself. You can go into the funds industry, and you know, the funds industry have a lot more luxurious locations than Carlo. So you could see them in Bermuda and Mauritius. And that's the thing, if you have a kid that's thinking of doing a professional qualification and they don't necessarily want to be an accountant, don't necessarily want to be a solicitor, being a company secretary is a qualification I would encourage anyone to look at, because you can go around the world with it. And you could go travelling to Australia for a couple of years, work in Sydney, go to Bahamas. I think there was one country there that were offering to bring people over to, was it Bermuda or something like that? And you could go over, work during the day and out to the beach for the afternoon, you know, on your qualification.
And I shouldn't have maybe detailed that it was just aimed at kids, because it's a perfect business or career to switch into when you're bored of being a heart surgeon or something. You can switch, and it's pretty quick, isn't it?
Yeah, you can do the qualification. There's a number of different ways. You can do the qualification directly with the Governance Institute. There is a course you can do through the Ulster University, and you can get your postgrad plus your ICSA qualification. So there's a number of different routes. There's even a certificate course with the Law Society and the Governance Institute, the Chartered Governance Institute, that would give you a step in the door if you want to get into this area, but don't necessarily think you're going to go all the way to do the full chartered qualification. That's a great starting point. And I would encourage anyone, and a lot of people just fall into this role, Conal. They just, no one, as you say, starts out going, I want to be a company secretary. You know,
I don't think people know about it.
That's the thing.
It's one of these little things, so nobody told me.
Yeah, we just fall into it. I did, there was a course in WIT, which was General Corporate Administration. I signed up for that course, did company law, loved it, and ended up qualifying, training KPMG and qualifying, and here I am now running my own business with in this area, you know, which is, you know, and it just, that's one area. If you look at the governor, the committee that we have, there's so many people from PLCs to heads of law firms, accountancy firms, all sitting on the ICSA committee.
Because one of the other things we should mention, you cannot find a company secretary for love nor money.
No.
So salaries are going up sharpish.
It is. Well, I think everyone is having a challenge, no matter what industry
Correct.
You're in.
Yeah.
But the more niche your industry, the more difficult it even is, again, to get someone. And we're trying to hire at the moment, in the process of doing it. And hopefully we have someone who's going to agree today to join us. But it is very, very difficult. And I think what we're suffering from is everyone's looking for qualified people at the moment. And when the last recession happened, there was a, you know, people weren't taking on trainees. So the gap in the market is now being suffered today because those people that should have had 4, 5, 6 years experience are not there. And we're all too busy to in some instances, take on, have the time to train people when you're trying to grow to that next level.
Sorry to go back to what we started off chatting about, because I've actually thought of, what is the final outcome of what we, you and I were just chatting there about do I leave it, do leave the company withering on the vine, or do I mean, you see, in your business, you'd only say, oh no, you have to file, you have to do it properly because you are what you are.
Sure.
But I am what I am, a messer. What's the actual answer, the real answer?
The real answer is, it's like everything with company law. You have to, when you sign up for a company, you've agreed to comply with the rules, mm-hmm. you know. And the one of the rules is, here's how you set it up and here's how you close it down, okay? And you've two options. Do a voluntary strike-off, bring the company up to date, apply to the company registration office to have the company struck off voluntary, and you get a letter of no objection from the revenue commissioner. So you're signing off on that side of things, that we've no more. So in the future, if you ever wanted to set up a business in the future, you've nothing to fear. That you've cleaned your slate, the company maybe has just naturally wound down, or maybe you have transferred a trade out into a new company or something like that, and you're just tidying up the steps. Yes, there's going to be instances where the company is late, it can't go to the district court to extend time to bring it up to date, it doesn't have the funds to pay an auditor to do the audit. So unfortunately, there is no other mechanism, there's nobody you can apply to get funding to wind up your company. It is in other jurisdictions, but not here. So in those instances, we are going to, and we see 5,000 on average companies pre-2020 being struck off involuntarily. But the risk that they run is twofold. One, the Director of Corporate Enforcement, as I mentioned, and facing disqualification proceedings, but also is wearing the revenue. If you come along in 2 years' time and set up a business and they see Connor Sweeney, hold on here, you were a director of this company and there was PAE and PRSI outstanding on those companies, you're going to have to try and discharge that. So they might try and catch you on that, and it might allow you.
I think with revenue, the word might doesn't come into it.
Well, I think it's
going to be two other things. One is that you fortunately and happily are a regular listener and you hear me talking about people getting investment and all.
Yes.
And you told me something very interesting.
Yes. When, you know, you feature, and it's brilliant that you feature these companies that are starting up or taking in new investment or whatever else. And that's fantastic. And it's brilliant to see that these companies are doing so successful. But when actually come to the nuts and bolts of investing into the company, and particularly where someone is or investors taking shares in a company, sometimes what happens is people have been so focused on setting up the business that they may have neglected keeping their statutory registers up to date, or they may have given shares to friends and family and stuff like that. And some of it is nearly done on a bar mat, you know, and I'll give you 20 shares or I'll give you 50 shares. But when those investors are coming in, they want to know, I'm buying 20% of CLS or I'm taking 50% equity in this. So companies really need to be prepared in advance for that and have the statutory register done up to date. That cap table you often hear talked about on this show, but that's really what you're looking at. Who currently has what shares in the company? And is there anybody there with shares in the company that haven't been dealt with? And somebody sitting in there, and we thought those shares were transferred, Conal. You promised you'd transfer those shares back to me. And now, 10 years' time, the company's been sold and suddenly Conal pops back up going, aha, Conor, remember those 20 shares? Now, they're a lot more valuable now than they were 10 years ago. So what we try and do, and I mentioned you had Stuart Fitzgerald on a previous about having your business ready for sale, and we see that all the time, is you're looking at the financial figures and having it ready to sale, but also trying to make sure that your statute register is up to date, that your minute books, because the law firm will come in doing the due diligence going, where's your share register? Your what? And suddenly you're into trying to prepare that, have that brought up to date. And particularly if it's gone back a number of years, it might be quite difficult to try track back on, you know, if that business transferred from your parents to the kids to, you know, there could have been a lot of share transfers done over the years, and that might be difficult to do. So what we always say to people is start now. If you're going to think you're selling your business in 2, 3, 5 years, do the due diligence now. So then it doesn't hold up a sale of a business or cost, you know, or maybe a shareholder or a potential buyer is going to walk away because they're going, actually, we actually don't know.
And do you know anybody who would help with that? Oh, you would, of course. Yes, CLS Chartered Secretaries. Because I have to give a good shout out as well, is the item that we were discussing. It was prompted by the email that you send out regularly. People should really sign up to that. Where will they find that?
They can sign up. That's our monthly newsletter. Yeah. I sit down every month and try to come up with...
I find it really, really good. Really interesting. That's why I was... when I saw that, I said, okay, that's a good question.
Yeah. Well, that's how we approach it. In the office every month, I say, right, what questions have we been asked? And then I just write the answer. I come up, okay, we've been asked this question. So if somebody's asking that a couple of times, hopefully there's a question. So you can sign up to our newsletter on our website, clschartedsecretaries.ie. Pop your email address in there, and it's once a month.
Two final things. One is, you just told me that you use and have used for years Tom Murphy's favourite product, De Facto Shaving Oil.
I do. I've been using it for, I'd say, nearly 10 years. It used to be called something else, and then they changed it to De Facto. Yeah. And yeah, I've been using it, and one bottle lasts you months. I know the ad says, but it really does. But it's brilliant. I use it every month.
Now just remind me again, you do have a beard.
Just a small bit down there.
Final question. Connor Sweeney, who would you hire in a heartbeat?
So this, always when I listened to the podcast, it's like, who would I say to Connell as I'd hire in a heartbeat? And I asked the guys in the office and the team in the office, and a couple of different ones, Amy Huberman and Brian O'Driscoll were one, but I think the one is Jurgen Klopp, the manager of Liverpool.
You're not the first who wanted to have him on. I can't remember who it was, but it was recent. And the person who did choose Jurgen Klopp wanted him because seemingly, and obviously I don't know him, but he's a very, very down-to-earth guy, and he works the room.
He does. He comes across very positive. He's set he's taken Liverpool from a team that should have been doing well to actually is doing well, and seems to have created an environment there that all the players seem to thrive in a happy space, but still can be, you know, he's still getting results, he's still delivering, but seems to do it in a way that brings everyone together. And I'm a Liverpool fan, so he's brought success to me.
And do you think, would he move to Carlow?
We're all in for remote working, so we have people working around the country, so he could, once he comes over for every quarter, we'd be happy enough to get a bit of insight from
him. I'd say you might prefer to go over.
Oh, we might too, yeah. Absolutely.
Connor, thank you so much. That's Connor Sweeney, the founder of CLS Chartered Secretaries. Do sign up to his go to the website and sign up to the newsletter. It's clschartedsecretaries.ie. Connor, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Thanks a million, Connor.
Everyday accounting can be a bit of a drama for SMEs. However, BigRentCloud.com takes the drama away with its simple and easy-to-use cloud-based accounting and payroll software designed for SME owners. Raise and send invoices, manage VAT reports and obligations, run management reports, link directly to Irish banks, automatically import purchase invoices, and so much more. All with 5-star customer support. BigRentCloud.com, 100% Irish-owned and a proud member of Team GBS.
Viscosity. When you shave, you want the highest viscosity because it helps the blade run smoother. De Facto, the world's best shaving oil, has incredible viscosity. That's why De Facto leaves your face, underarms or legs nick-free. Higher viscosity makes blades last longer. De Facto is the best for your skin and your pocket. DeFactoShave.com.
All That Great Business Show advertisers are Team GBS approved. Back them.
You're probably aware there is a lot of talk at the moment about power shortages across Europe in winter. It's well worth listening back to episode 79, recorded back in March, when David Horgan of Dublin-based Petrel Resources predicted as much, and you can hear how bad it could get, according to David. Episode 79. Now, just like you, we are in business and we love finding out ways of cutting our business costs. To this end, we spotted an Austrian company with a unit in Ireland that can save you over €300 on a mobile phone, over €1,000 on a laptop, or how about saving €1,500 on a desktop PC? So what's the catch, I hear you say? Well, strictly speaking, there is no catch because the key is in the company name. They are called Refurbed, and they, well, refurbish perfectly good tech, which is perfectly brilliant idea for a startup business, we thought. Pádraig Power is Refurb's Ireland country manager, and he joins me now. Pádraig Power, welcome to That Great Business Show.
Thanks very much, Conal. Thank you for having me and for the great intro as well.
Well, it is a most curious company, but before I get there, I have a habit, and I haven't prepped you for this, of doing a little bit of digging. You were in UCC.
Yes.
You won the All-Ireland InterVarsity and won the UCC Goes Dancing 2012 competition.
I did indeed, yes.
You have that up on your LinkedIn. I find it curious what people up on LinkedIn.
Yeah, I mean, why not? You have to show off the personality as well, I suppose.
You were also school sports superstar 2 years consecutively.
There we go. Yeah.
You're a player. Refurbed. Tell us the history of the company. It came from, it is based in Austria.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's an Austrian company. We've three co-founders, which are Peter, Killian and Jürgen. Basically, Peter is the co-founder who came up with the initial concept. So he would be somebody who is quite eco-conscious and also, I mean, conscious aware of what he's buying and how much things cost. So he wanted to get a smartphone, decided he's going to get a second-hand one because better for the environment, better for his pocket. And then he got it, and within a week, it just absolutely went kaput. He'd no warranty. There was no guarantee of any sort there. And then basically, he was just left with a loss in his pocket and a broken phone that he'd throw away. So he's very upset by this. And he said, how can this be something that a customer can do, but also have the trust there and have the warranty behind it? So he came up with Refurbed. So basically, all the devices then are fully refurbished, 40-step process, cheaper, everything there, but the customer has at least a 12-month warranty as well. So we kind of know that we're ticking off all of the bases and all of the boxes for the customer.
And it's all big brand name. And I presume, I shouldn't even say this, I presume it's all kosher.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Don't worry, everything is fully certified. Everything's from original manufacturers. So all good there, all in line with the brands.
And one of the things that you do is you give a 12-month warranty and you, before you sell it, you do obviously do a refurb on it. Where is the refurb being done? It's not done in Ireland, sure it's not.
Some is done in Ireland. So we have a host of merchants all around Europe. They all go through rigorous quality tests and training tests before we allow them to sell via Refurbed. And then basically we have certain criteria in place where we monitor them each month, monitor the quality of the products, check out everything, even down to like customer service. So they're all around Europe. We have a number in Ireland right now as well, which I'm very happy about because it's always nice, obviously, to have that extra kind of local aspect.
Give us an idea, maybe a company that you have worked with or for, and that they, how much they saved. I mean, the savings are, according to your website,
yes,
the savings are pretty chunky. I saw I mentioned there, the PC. I'm actually doing you a disservice. There was a more than a 1,500 quid saving on it, and it's all proper spec and all.
Yeah, absolutely. So firstly, as you said, everything is fully up to spec, just like you're getting it brand new. And the savings are really, really good, particularly if you are looking at desktops, laptops, but all tech, including phones as well. I suppose for us, most of our business comes from end consumers. We actually don't have a huge cohort of businesses who are specifically buying from Refurbed right now.
Yet.
Exactly, yet. Because I do think that they're missing out. But I did have a little look into this and I had one example there where we had a small business. They bought two laptops, seven monitors, a MacBook and a desktop. got the whole thing for less than €3,500. And then when you're comparing it, because I added up all the costs as well from original, it would have been about €6,350. So the saving was nearly €3,000, about 46% for like absolutely no difference in the quality of the products.
That is nice.
Yes.
And we are fully compliant on this program or on this podcast. And I did check with you. All the prices are inclusive of that.
Yes, all the prices are inclusive of that. If you are, so everything on the site is fully inclusive. It includes all your delivery, all your VAT, everything like that. You can, if you're a business purchasing, enter your European VAT number if you are a VAT exempt company. But just to make sure it's a European VAT number and not your local one. So if there is anybody checking it out.
Oh, that's curious. Okay, I must keep an eye on that one. The business model itself, where are you sourcing all of your gear from? Because you do tell me that if somebody comes along and looks for a reasonable number of units of a particular model, you can get them.
Yeah, absolutely. So the vast majority of the products come from large companies. So originally, companies like Stripe or others, not saying it is Stripe, but companies of that size generally would have procedures in place where their employees would have to replenish or change their devices every year, every 2 years, etc. And before, they used to just be chucked out. Whereas now, our refurbishers will get all of those devices, fully refurbish them through the 40-step process, and then have this stock of devices that we can send out to our customers or to other businesses who are looking for it. So that's where we get the majority of the products.
And you're a decent-sized company now. Across Europe, you have?
Across Europe, employees, about 250.
Okay. Yeah. So how many customers around Europe would you have as well? I mean, what's the actual size of what you're doing? Because you are competing. As I drove up here, I was thinking, one of your competitions, now you may not agree with me, you know those repair shops for phones? Mm. You're kind of competing with them because they also sell refurbished, or they say they're refurbished.
Yeah, absolutely. So I suppose to answer the first question, I don't have an exact number, but definitely well over 100,000, in the hundreds of thousands of customers we have. Yeah. We've a lot of customers around Europe.
And remind me, when was the business set up?
The business is just over 5 years old.
That's a nice bit of growth, isn't it?
Yeah, no, it's going really well. And I mean, even though the business is 5 years old, it's only came to Ireland a year ago. It's only been in some other countries like Sweden. It only joined this year, the Netherlands and Denmark also this year. So the growth really is quite big. With regards then the local repair shops or local stores like that, absolutely, they would be competitors in the fact that people, a lot of customers, myself included, pre-joining Refurbed, wouldn't really know the difference between secondhand versus refurbished, or wouldn't really know, why wouldn't I just go to the local shop? But a lot of the time with them, there isn't that 12-month warranty. The products haven't gone through the rigorous testing, or if they have been refurbished or repaired, it's not with the original certified manufacturing kind of parts. So that's where the difference is. And of course, I'm sure there are some local stores that do that. But if you are going, I just very much recommend asking those questions. If that's not the case, definitely pop on to Refurbed.
And I know I was flagging you there about the UCC goes dancing, but your background after college was in credit unions. How did Refurb find you?
So they found me on LinkedIn. So I was in two different credit unions, I think. Total period of time was about 4 years. And then you can have on your LinkedIn if you want to say that you're open to work. So I didn't actively search for anything or anything like that, but you can set this little tab on your profile, and then basically only recruiters or people who have the certain LinkedIn HR professional badge or membership or whatever you could call it, they can search for people who are open. And clearly I must have been in the list because they got in touch.
How did they work out from a credit union or two credit unions in your case that you wanted to work in with a company refurbing tech?
Yeah, I know. It is a weird stretch, but I suppose firstly from my LinkedIn, my own profile is very KPI heavy. So it's all about the stats, what I've done, what I've achieved, which is something that they needed. And then aside from that, I do have a lot of the local community aspects, which when you are a company that's Austrian based, you kind of need that. You're not going to have that expertise over in Austria. So they wanted somebody who really knew the Irish market and could make genuine changes and, I suppose, improvements to what Refurb does for Ireland. So that's why they kind of saw me as a good bridge there.
And I also love the model that you are dispersed all over the country. Now, when I say you, there are how many total? Four people working for the company in Ireland?
Yeah, there's about four Irish people, but they're not all actually even in Ireland.
Around
Europe, yeah. So we're remote first. So you can, I mean, if I wanted to, I'm very happy to be in Ireland right now. But if I wanted to, I could move to Spain tomorrow. It would be fine. So it's a really nice setup. And part of that as well is the whole sustainability. They don't want to have offices everywhere because it's just wasteful for money and for actual resources as well.
So say all of us. Now, what is your actual job? I mean, obviously you come on to Ireland's Best Business Podcast to make sure to drive sales. But how are you actually developing customers?
Yeah, sure. So I suppose the majority of my work is in the marketing aspect. But then also I make sure to fight for our customers end day as well, because we do have merchants all over Europe, like I said. But not necessarily do all of them want to ship to Ireland, or can they all ship to Ireland? Because Ireland is a more difficult country to get to because you have to go overseas if you're shipping your products. So I'll always make sure as well that I'm fighting and getting every single product on the site, getting everything at the best rates we can have, the best quality. Well, quality's standard, but just the best of everything for the Irish customers. And then aside from that, everything we can do to localize what Refurb does. I know I'm here to talk more about the finances side of things, but a quick example would be we plant a tree for every device we sell. They are all planted in African countries for the most part. But when I joined, I was like, no, I feel like Irish people really like to support Irish. So now all Irish customers have the opportunity to plant their tree in Ireland and make sure that they're making a contribution to the home, I suppose.
Well, it's a nice thing to do. You have a little bit of catching up to do because we had Greenbelt on last week. They have planted in Ireland. Now, they are the Ireland's largest planter of trees. 500 million trees.
Yeah, there's a little stretch to go, all right.
A lot of trees. Now, you're also very keen to tell the world that you're not just mobile phones, you're not just laptops. You are as much tech as you can do, such as,
as you said, smartphones, laptops, tablets, audio devices, cameras, your desktops, PCs, printers, scanners, gaming consoles. So anything you can really think of, smartwatches as well, actually, that's a big one I forgot. But yeah, pretty much anything you can think of. And if we don't currently have it, it's certainly on the agenda to get it. So we are kind of trying to make sure that we have a huge array of products, because firstly, we don't want someone to just be able to get a phone and then be like, yeah, grand, done. I myself have a lot of different tech. You know, I have a lot I need to go to, or to go for, I suppose. And then secondly, it would be the worst thing ever if someone's trying to be sustainable and save money and they're like, yeah, I'll go onto the site, and then we don't have the products. I mean, it kind of makes it difficult for a consumer. So we want to make sure everything's as easy as possible.
So anything I see on the site is available?
Yes, everything's available. There are certain products that we have lower stock in. So keep an eye. They can go in and out of stock sometimes.
Can you put up alerts?
Alerts will be, yes, there will be some. They're not specific alerts of when it's coming in, but there are alerts on the site of, this is an item that has low stock. So if you see it, we'd recommend, if you really want it, to go for it now.
Buy now.
Yeah, exactly, exactly.
If you have hundreds of thousands of customers, you must be shipping a lot of stock. Mm-hmm. And what about availability of that stock? Like if somebody in Germany buys 10 of your laptops and I'm sitting in Ireland and I'm trying to buy those ones over there, they're just out of stock, is it? Just like any other shop?
Yes, but that's very rarely the case. Like I said, we do have merchants all around Europe. I think we definitely have over 150, but I think it's closer to 200 merchants that we have right now. And all of them have a huge host of devices in their own right. So between them all, there is an economy of scale that we have, and we've built up over the last 5 years. So that makes it very unlikely that the products will go out.
How are you doing in terms of picking up customers in Ireland?
Really well. What's really, really nice, so I joined in November and Refurb launched in Ireland in March last year. And even since November, it's so nice to see, number one, the amount of repeat customers that we have. And number two, the amount of customers who are coming to us and saying, I'm coming to you because my family member had a really good experience. I'm coming because my friend said they got their phone for X amount cheaper. I want to get mine for X amount cheaper. So what's really nice to see is, of course, my own marketing efforts working and like bringing people in and having more people hear about us. But secondly, to see the genuine word of mouth and to see it spread that way, I think it's encouraging because you know you're doing it right when that's the case.
They have big ambitions at the top, isn't that right?
Mm-hmm, they do indeed.
Such as,
we do want to be essentially Europe's refurbished kind of Amazon, I suppose, would be one of the terms that we have there. We want to have as much as we can on the site. And as I said, right now, it's electronics and we want to really flesh out our electronics. As we go down the line, I'm sure we'll be adding more things than just electronics to the website as well. In Austria right now, and Germany, they have a second category of products, which is fashion. So
I saw that.
Refurbished fashion, yeah, which is really cool. And I'm hoping to get it over here, but we'll let the guys, you know, find their feet with it first and then I'll bring it here when it's perfect. So it's great.
Excellent. Really is lovely, lovely idea. Now, first of all, give a big shout out to the website. So anybody who wants to find you will find you. Spell it because there's a little spelling issue here.
Yes, I will. So it's refurbed. So that's refurbed.ie. So the ED is important.
Exactly. Refurbed.ie. Final question. You know what I'm going to ask you? Who would you hire in a heartbeat?
Yes, I actually, would you believe it or not, you prepped me on this question and I forgot about it. But the person...
You see, at least unlike other people who come here who haven't read their emails, you have admitted that I did prep you on this.
You did. You prepped me and I did actually note down who and everything. I just absolutely forgot the question was coming. But it would actually be my friend and former colleague, Katie Kavanagh. So Katie, even though she doesn't work in marketing, she actually works in HR, or should I say people operations. I believe that's the PC term. Yes, that's what we say these days. But Katie works in people operations for HubSpot. I worked with her previously when I worked in Hayfield Manor in Cork. And she also actually did the same masters as me just a year after I did it. But yeah, she's a brilliant person to work with. Really professional, really intelligent, but also doesn't take things too seriously and can make sure that everyone on the team has fun and a good work-life balance. So I think she's an asset to any team.
Was she, by any chance, your dance partner?
She wasn't my dance partner. No, that would have been a good link, though.
Okay. Katie Kavanagh from HubSpot, you are hired. And Party Power, thank you so much for joining us on That Great Business Show.
Perfect. Thank you so much, Conal, and delighted you asked me to come on.
And that is it from That Great Business Show, episode 95. Share it with your pals. Dump the link into your WhatsApp and send it to anyone you know in business. Then they can listen in the car, walking the dog, up in the air in their drones maybe, watching the kids play. They all think you're great for thinking of them. And that's what we do. We make you a nicer person. Would you like your business to play with the big boys? Well, you can join great companies like Big Red Cloud, Microfinance Ireland, ISME, Virgin Media, Uder Osnogardochte, that advertise with us. And your business could do the same. And we do all the work for you. Get in touch on LinkedIn, please. We work with our great friends here at the Dublin South Podcast Studios, including sound engineer Brian Strictly, No Dancing Begley, who makes our podcast super sharp. Later, studio manager Peter Twinkletoes Rice adds tweaks to us to give us the world's finest sound. And if you want to record a podcast, do use the team here at the Dublin South Podcast Studios. They are great, and that's why I choose to work with them. And if you like the media group to produce a podcast for you, as we do for the Love Irish Food Group and others, then I am your Bohol. Talk to me, Conal O'Moran. Find me on LinkedIn. All of our great business insights and tips are brought to you, as always, thanks to our sponsor, De Facto Shaving Oil, the world's best all-natural shaving oil. They back us. Please back them. DeFactoShave.com will get them. And don't forget to buy Business Plus magazine, where we now have our regular column all about the podcast. So from me, Conal O'Moran, Míle Buíochas for listening, agus slán tomh.